Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we feature an interview from our archives with novelist Rilla Askew. Her most recent novel, Kind of Kin, came out at the beginning of last year to great acclaim. It's now out in softcover. Like all of Askew's novels, Kind of Kin is set in Oklahoma. But unlike most of her work, which is set in the past, this book takes place in contemporary Oklahoma and was inspired in part by the passage of House Bill 1804 back in 2007, one of the toughest anti-illegal immigration laws in the country, which, in addition to cracking down on illegal immigration, made it a felony to harbor undocumented immigrants. And that is the beginnings of the novel. Bob Brown is a hardworking farmer and devout Christian who's arrested on an anonymous tip that he's harboring undocumented workers on his farm. With his arrest, the main character, Sweet Kirkendall, Brown's daughter, has to juggle multiple roles, getting her father out of jail, who's not cooperating, her own family with problems of its own, caretaking for an infirm elderly relative, and now Dustin, a nephew who was living with the patriarch at the time of the arrest. Hot-button politics makes her task no easier in this tale of family, faith, and community in Oklahoma. Kind of Kin is now out in softcover from Echo. We spoke with Rilla Askew at the beginning of 2013, and we repeat the conversation today on Studio Tulsa. Rilla Askew, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
And this new book, I think it's your best, and it's taken right out of our headlines over the last few years here in Oklahoma, having to do with the anti-immigration bill, which I believe is 1804. I think in the book it's 1830 or 1840,
yeah,
something like
fictional
that.
Fictional in the book.
But what's interesting is you've really blended a lot of real life and the fictional in this book. But it goes back to the passage of House Bill 1804, and you started seeing the effects. Is that right?
That's very much part of it. Even before I really saw the effects or was thinking directly about the effects, was the abstract notion of it. I sort of woke up one day. I was in Oklahoma, and you know, I was reading in the newspaper, the Tulsa World and other newspapers, about House Bill 1804 going into effect on November 1st, 2007. And I hadn't known when they passed it. I wasn't paying attention. It was just suddenly there. And yes, I do have people both connected to my family and just friends who were directly affected by the bill. But it was also, I guess you would say, a sense of who we are as Oklahomans. And we have to remember that that was well before Arizona passed their state law, before Alabama did. It was one of the first, if not the first, state anti-illegal immigration laws.
And it made a felony, not only for the immigrants themselves, but anybody who helps them in any way.
Anybody who helps them.
That means harbors them, hires them, whatever.
Harbors them, hires them. And of course, that's still in effect. I mean, we just got a headline the other day where our state attorney general intends to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law every element of 1804 that has not been overturned, which will, you know, create complications for people, let me say. But what I'm interested in is family, and what I'm interested in is human beings and how we interact with one another. And I'm interested in how people of faith deal with certain kinds of issues. So someone may, you know, there's a strong evangelical sanctuary movement that was even prior to the state laws going into effect. So sometimes people who have an issue of faith or conscience, on the one hand, find themselves having to go against the laws of either their nation or their state. And that's a complication, but that, of course, makes for good fiction. It makes for good storytelling.
Right. And, of course, at the very beginning of this book, the first section is called A Felon and a Christian.
Indeed.
And it centers around Bob Brown, who is a devout Christian, although he's not of one faith. He's a dabbler.
He's a dabbler. Yes, that's what his daughter calls him. She thinks he needs to settle down and find a good church home. That's her opinion on the matter. But yes, he draws from a lot of different Christian faiths, and so he goes to a number of different churches. And as his daughter Sweet will say, you know, he'll go to a Catholic church or an African American church or a Pentecostal church. They're all Christian to him. And so his sense of his own Christian duty comes from his reading of the Bible and his belief, which is not doctrinal. It's not connected to a particular denomination.
Well, it's really interesting as this story unfolds, because it delves into this issue of being a Christian and that idea of sanctuary, but also of just conscientious objection, if you will, to what you would consider an unjust law.
Exactly.
It also gets into a lot of hypocrisy.
Does it? I don't think I would. That's interesting because I don't think I was.
Well, I'm thinking not necessarily on the Christian part, but on your politician's part, on your sheriff's part.
This is true.
The sheriff who arrests Bob Brown. Mm-hmm. We ought to go through a little bit of the plot. Bob Brown has been arrested for harboring, about 14, 16
undocumented
workers. A priest is also, I guess, a reverend. A Pentecostal pastor is also arrested at the same time. He was tipped off that a raid was happening down in Hevener, mm-hmm. and he and Bob cooked up this scheme of housing them in his barn mm-hmm. while the heat sort of comes and goes. But somebody turns him in, and he's arrested. And due to this house bill in the book, which is very similar to House Bill 1804, he's arrested on a felony charge of harboring illegal aliens. Mm-hmm. So we start to see this effect first on his grandson who's living with him, Dustin Brown. Mm-hmm. And you tell the story through a variety of viewpoints. The other would be Sweet Kirkendall, who's sort of really the vessel of this book, really. I mean, she's dealing with the most.
Yes, there are four primary point of view characters, but she's the one who has the most problems. She's the one who has the narrative arc. She has to get from here to there. And she's the one who has to take care of her family when they are directly affected by this law.
And her family is spread all over the place. She has illegal immigrants in her family. This mm-hmm. is also splitting her family. Mm-hmm. She's dealing with two boys that don't get along, and one who's really worried because his one caregiver, his grandfather, is in jail. And she's got a lot on her plate.
She does. And one of the other elements in the book is that Bob Brown chooses to do this because of his conscience. But another element of that is that he, in some ways, makes things very, very difficult for his family. So the consequences, both for his grandson and his daughter, and ultimately his granddaughter and her husband, it spins out. He makes the choice. He makes the choice to stay in jail. He could bail out. You know, he could bond out, I should say. Yeah. Not bail out.
In fact, the judge is willing to release him on his own recognizance,
right.
except he doesn't want answer to any of the charges.
That's
He basically goes
mute. Uh-huh.
And that basically throws him in jail.
Yeah. So he is a man of conscience behaving in a way where he's standing up for what he believes. But the consequences of that are very negative for his family. So it's just another moral question that the characters have to face and that we face, I think, on a daily basis.
Now, you throw this around from voice to voice. I think you said there are about four voices. There's a first Dustin Brown. This is the grandson who's just doesn't know what to do. He doesn't really like being with his aunt mm-hmm. And is certainly his cousin. He just wants to go back to the farm where they live. He goes back and he says, well, there's nothing there. And then he finds that there's one undocumented worker who somehow escaped the dragnet, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then he's torn by his own sort of decisions.
I think everybody in the novel, all the characters, have to make a choice, including this 10-year-old boy, Dustin, and the lawmaker who is entirely fictional, but she's the sponsor of the bill. And she has to make choices. Sweet has to make choices. Bob Brown, in fact, has made his choice, but then he's stagnant because he's in jail. What choice can he make now? What actions can he take? Not a lot, but he's still struggling with the decisions he has made and what he needs to do and the actions that he needs to take. And Luis, the Mexican character, has to make choices.
This is the documented worker that's left in the barn. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you tell the story through all four of these voices. Tell us about that decision making as far as telling the story through one character as opposed to four.
The book began with Dustin talking in my head. I just woke up one morning. I was in Norman teaching at OU, and it was February of 2008, right when this bill was beginning to have its effect. And I just woke up with this kid's voice saying, quoting his aunt, saying, your granddaddy's a felon. He's a felon and a Christian. He says he's a felon because he's a Christian. And so I thought the novel was going to be entirely in Dustin's voice. You know, I followed his voice for a time, and I thought it was going to be sort of like Huckleberry Finn going on a journey and adventure. But Sweet, the aunt, sort of
took over the novel.
She did. She just bullied her way in there. And
then once you decide to have two characters, then you need to really...
And then you have another one.
Yeah.
And I was still writing Dustin when I began Luis's story, which is told in present tense instead of past tense. It's the conceit of those pages and that voice is that it's really his thoughts in Spanish, simply translated
into English.
Yeah. And then Sweet had her say, and then the lawmaker began to have her say. So it just, it sort of went from there.
And then this is interesting because Monica Morehouse is the state representative who's introduced this bill, got it passed. She has great political ambitions, no real connections to the state, although she mm-hmm. claims to have this sort of connection. And again, this is where the hypocrisy comes in. You know, she claims mm-hmm. to be very religious. She's not. It's everything's for appearance's sake. It's a very cynical politician, basically. Mm-hmm. Why did you feel compelled to tell that side of the story?
Well, that's interesting. I did not want to make the lawmaker in the novel anything like any actual Oklahoma legislator. I didn't want it to be some thinly veiled portrait of someone. And so she's not like anyone. She's a completely imagined character. She's not like anyone I know. But I know that from all sides of the aisle, both sides of the aisle, everywhere, we know this in our politics today, people will use issues to move forward with their personal agenda or their political ambitions. And so I made that, you know, it's a narrative choice, but I wanted her to be an outsider. I wanted her to not be. A number of people said to me, well, it's very even-handed and that the book is, and I didn't want it to be a polemic. I didn't want it to be, you know, I don't even now want to say, you know, all people who create these kinds of laws are only using them for political ambition. It's not meant to be that way. She's a very specific, individualized character. Nevertheless, all laws have effect on all American citizens and non-citizens who happen to be living here, that this is what I wanted to talk about, that when these decisions are made, it affects people's lives. And it doesn't just affect, for instance, that this particular law. We could talk about many other mm-hmm. laws, but this is the one that the novel is dealing with. It's not just illegal immigrants who are affected by the law, as many Oklahoma businessmen will tell you that they are affected by the law, as families who are mixed families, whether they're, you know, Hispanic or Mexican immigration, or in this case, this is an Anglo family. Yes. They're, you know, it's a white family who happens to have one member of the family who's an undocumented worker. So the threads of the American fabric and the Oklahoma fabric are all intertwined, and anything that happens politically affects all of us, as we know.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned the family. There is a niece of mm-hmm. Sweet who is who's married an undocumented worker. They're married. You would think in America, if you're married, if it's a real marriage, you can stay here. But in fact,
it's not true.
If this you marry them that, when they're undocumented,
it doesn't make any difference. It's still the problem is that the rules have been. This is getting ready to change apparently with the new immigration changes that are moving forward. But for years it's been this way. The undocumented worker has to go back to the country of origin and wait and apply from there and be separated from the family. And the wait, especially for Mexican people who are applying, and Central America, you know, South American countries, but especially from Mexico, as we know, is 10, 12 years. So you're separated from your family while your children
basically
are growing
ending
up.
Basically ending your marriage.
Exactly. And you're not supporting your children. You're not. But there was a time when you could when someone could marry someone for a green card. That time is gone. Mm. And so this is part of what's broken about our immigration system. And it's something that a lot of people don't understand. And so when they don't have a direct connection to immigration issues, they just say, you know, it's against the law. They're here illegally. They should just go back and get in line and do it properly. Not really understanding how very, very difficult it is, even when you're married, even when you have an entire family here that you're looking to support and your children that you're looking to support. There's no path.
Yeah. My guest today is Rilla Askew. Her latest book is titled Kind of Kin, and it tells a story of a family dealing with the effects of a fictionalized version of Oklahoma House Bill 1804. Now, as you were writing this, this was when the scare, because there were real effects. There were a lot of undocumented workers who left the state. You know, after 4 years, it's sort of calmed down, and I don't think you're seeing a lot of arrest on this law today, are we?
I don't think we are now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of gone its course. As you were writing this book and sort of when the worst effects weren't realized, did you ever feel like, well, maybe this is not the story I need to tell, or were you absolutely committed to this particular story?
And no, I know too many families that have been very, very directly affected by it, and people who, you know, were stopped for traffic violations and their, you know, immigration status checked and quickly, you know, put in the Tulsa County Jail for the crime of driving without a driver's license, for instance.
Yeah.
And then they're bused to Paul's Valley, to the Garvin County Immigration Detention Center, and then they're bused down to Mexico. And there are many families. This doesn't make the news. It's not that it's not happened.
Yeah.
And it still probably is happening. You know, much of the action in the novel takes place in the town of Wilburton down in Latimer County. And the places are all, in fact, real. Many of the characters
Are
fully imagined.
Well, Cedar's not real.
Cedar is not real.
That's your fictional town you've been writing about in all your books.
Since Strange Business, since back in the day. But Wilburton is real.
Sure, yeah.
And how, in order to go visit prisoners who are in prison in Latimer County Jail, you have to go stand outside a fence to talk to them through the fence.
One day a week
on Sunday.
Yeah.
Half an hour for the women and half an hour for the men. So those are all, it's all factual. It's how it's done. And I know of a small church congregation there, the Methodist Church, a story that was told to me whereby one of the busboys at the local Mexican restaurant, who was dear to all of them and beloved by all of them, they would go in there every Sunday after church, and he was going to be deported. He was arrested and was in the Latimer County Jail and was going to be deported. And I was told the story about all of the church going to the jail in a sleet and freezing rain on the Sunday afternoon when they could go visit him, and him coming to the fence and talking to them. And their complete powerlessness to do anything about it. And they also knew he was from Central America, but he was going to be deported to Mexico. And they didn't, you know, and his English was not very good, but they've known him for years. And there's just nothing anybody can do. You know, once the immigration took him into custody, then they just couldn't bus him down to Texas and then, you know, walk him across the border. And then they just leave them there with whatever money they happened to have in their pocket when they were arrested. That's it. And then they're going to be making phone calls or doing whatever. They don't know what happened to him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
But the story there is these people from this little small town in southeastern Oklahoma whose hearts are not paying attention to that law, whose hearts are paying attention to that human being standing on the other side of the fence in the sleet and freezing rain, being separated from his family and sent away, and they can't do anything about it.
And in this book, you give another group of churchgoers a little more power.
I do.
We'll leave it at that.
I do. That's the great thrill of fiction. You can make the story go wherever you want.
Well, one of the things, you know, I've read all the books that you've set, and to me, this seems like the most non-fictional fictional story that you've written. Would you say that's? I mean, there's maybe the Beulah book, which was about the race riot, that that had a lot of history in it and nonfiction in it, but this seems to have, to me, even a little more.
That's an interesting thought. I don't know that I have thought of it that way, because certainly, as with all my books, I've done a lot of research. I went and spent time at the Capitol and watched how laws were passed, and there were several state legislators who were so helpful to me, and I have to sort of give a shout out to State Representative Jeannie McDaniel was one who really was, and Brian Reniger, who is our representative from McAllister. He knew I was going to make this fictional representative from McAllister, so he knows good and well I'm not writing about him. He was really, really helpful. And the effects of the law and how things are done at the Capitol and how things, you know, what happens with prisoners. I went and sat in you know, hearings in the—
You talked to a court reporter, yeah.
Yeah, Latimer County Court, and, you know, watched the processes. So there's all that, but I wasn't thinking about it not being, you know, being nonfiction. I wasn't thinking of it as an issue-driven book or ripped from the headlines kind of book. I was thinking about it in terms of character, and I was thinking about it, as I always do, in terms of Oklahoma character and who we are. I'm always interested in who we are as Americans, who Americans are as Americans, but I'm especially interested in who we are as Oklahomans. And we have many, many faces, and we have an idea about ourselves, one being our absolute friendliness, which is something that's very, very true, being people of faith, which is also very true. I think sometimes, especially politically, there's sometimes an assumption that we are all the same. And my experience is that we are all not. So that people who, for instance, may be very conservative in terms of religion and certain social issues, they're the very people that I see reaching out to people who are affected, for instance, by this law. So I see this in my family. I see it in my my parents' church.
Sometimes there's a disconnect between, you know, what they believe politically but what they believe personally.
Sometimes there is. And yeah. And that's an element in the book where there's even a line where this church community says, well, the thing is, it was their own Mexican. You know, they may not believe in illegal immigration, and they may think that it's wrong and it's illegal, and they may, you know, have not much thought about what happens to others. But when it's that busboy from Adelitas, when it's, you know, when it's your son-in-law, when it's someone that you know, everything changes. So I'm very interested in that. And yet, both in terms of America and in terms of Oklahoma, some of our darkest shames have been things that we have done through law, whether that's slavery, whether that's taking away the land of the Indians, whether it's the first laws passed by the Oklahoma State Legislature after we became a state were laws of segregation, Jim Crow laws, or whether it's, you know, incarcerating Japanese Americans during World War II. It's one of the reasons I was perturbed by this law when it first went into effect, when we had no – it's hard to remember going back to 2007, 2008, when we had no precedent for this. There were not other states doing this yet. And it seemed to me that this was a particularly worrisome and troubling turn of events to make it illegal if you were a pastor, for instance, who had a congregation who where some of the family members may or may not be, you know, legal, that it would make it a crime for you to protect them. Or if you happen to be someone who was married to an illegal immigrant and you happen to be driving him to work and you got stopped, you could be arrested for a felony for transporting an illegal immigrant. And so there are many, many kinds of consequences. And I thought, having done all that research about the climate that led to the Tulsa race riot for the novel Fire and Beulah, I felt that it was the same kind of thing. When you begin to demonize any class of people, any group of people, any bunch of people, it can create that kind of climate where they become the alien, they become the other, they become objectified. And then they're no longer ours.
I was struck by a throwaway line in the book by Bob Brown, the man who's been arrested. I think he was saying, well, you know, at one point we were, when we first came to Oklahoma, we were illegal immigrants, because I assume he's talking about the fact that they settled in Indian territory before they were really allowed to, were allowed to.
This is true, and this is my own family story.
Yeah.
They came into Choctaw Nation in the late 1800s. When no white person was allowed to own land, or they had no legal right to own land. They basically were squatters.
Yeah.
And then eventually the laws changed, and eventually they were able to, you know, purchase land. But both sides of my family,
I think that's a very telling element to this story of, you know, who is undocumented or legal and who's not. Because this whole state is based on the fact that this was the last big place of immigration. Where the doors were open to everybody.
Well, but they weren't in the beginning. What people who don't know a lot of Oklahoma's history, we have the image of the land runs, and those lands out in western Oklahoma were opened for the land runs and through lottery and so forth. They were lands that had been taken away from the Indian tribes and given to people who were homesteaders. But in eastern Oklahoma, Creek Nation, Cherokee Nation, Choctaw Nation, especially Choctaw Nation, they didn't hold their own sort of borders secure. And by the late 1800s, before the Dawes Act, there were like, you know, I think nine or ten whites for every Choctaw in Choctaw Nation. So it sort of like got away from them.
And of course, the Dawes Act actually created allotments and then those lands were opened.
Exactly. Individual ownership for people who it was not a part of their culture to have individual ownership.
Right.
So we have a lot of those stories, and many Oklahomans can go back in their own family's story. And people, especially in the western part of the state, they know where their homestead was when the families came in on the land runs or through the lotteries. But in eastern Oklahoma, there are a lot of us who can go back and start saying, well, how did we get here? Yeah. How did my grandfather become a sawmiller in southeastern Oklahoma in Choctaw Nation in 1887? How did that happen?
My guest today is Real Askew. Her new book is titled Kind of Kin. It deals with immigration. It also deals with the families dealing with the effects of a fictionalized version of Oklahoma House Bill 1806. And of course, you leave the novel, things are resolved, but not really resolved.
They're not fixed.
Yeah, they're not fixed, no.
And they're not fixed in our country. We have a lot ahead of us. We have a lot to face in these next several years. But I think immigration is going to be something that is going to be dealt with.
Do you think maybe the tide has turned? I mean, this book comes out of the perhaps one of the darkest days in our debate over immigration. I mean, I think maybe the Arizona laws mm-hmm. were perhaps the worst. But there seems to be a big change, and I think the election has had something to do with that. I think seeing where draconian actions have been put into place, like in Alabama, and all of a sudden crops are rotting in the field.
Because there are many, many, you know, citizens and people who are people from the dominant culture, the Anglo culture, as I am, who simply don't know about it. So it's only an abstraction to them, and they haven't really seen or understood what all the consequences are or how entirely dependent on undocumented workers this nation is and has been for a very, very long time. And there have begun to be more stories of what happens when families are broken apart. And, you know, or young people who've grown up in the United States all of their lives, they speak no Spanish, but they were brought here when they were two or three, and their father gets deported, and he can't get back, and then their mother wants to go be with the father, and then these kids go to Mexico to a culture that they're not familiar with. You know, they're just American kids. So, and some of those stories are being told now, and so, it is true. Americans, Oklahomans, are good-hearted people and a generous people. Also have a mean streak a mile wide. and both things are true. Yeah. But I think when people begin to see the human side of a story, their eyes begin to open. And that's one of the great values of fiction, because you see the story from inside the character and you understand it. It's not an abstraction. It's not numbers. It's not them. It's us. Because when we're reading the story and we're trying to keep our family together as Sweet is trying to do, or any of those other journeys that the characters are on, a kind of empathy develops. And I also just think it's a conversation that the nation is ready to have. We didn't understand, and when I say we, I'm speaking of the dominant culture, did not understand for a long time how broken the system was, how complicated it was for anyone to come here legally, or how many undocumented workers were just continuing to pour in until suddenly somebody said, oh, let's shut the door. Oh, wait a minute. And then we began to get the state laws and began to, have broader attention to the fact that we haven't dealt with immigration for a very, very long time. Then, the pendulum swings, and it swung very, very far to these draconian, really ruthless consequences for many, many families. And then it swings back the other way. And I think it's when people who are not directly affected or not directly knowledgeable, the same thing happened with slavery. I mean, it's happened with, under many, many circumstances where we begin to say, oh, wait a minute, this is not right. This is not right. And I think that there are more people who are not of the immigrant culture or not of Hispanic culture who are beginning to open their eyes and say, wait a minute, this is not right.
The name of the book is Kind of Kin. Rilla Askew, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Oklahoma novelist Rilla Askew speaking with us in the beginning of 2013 when her most recent novel, Kind of Kin, came out in hardcover. Kind of Kin comes out in softcover from Echo starting tomorrow. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.